I, her face still flushed with excitement and expectation. He didn't try to stop her. He returned to the Tanaquil in the warm hush of midday, the sun spilling in faint, thin streamers through the thick canopy of the old growth. Clouds scudded overhead in billowing white clusters, throwing shadows to the earth, and the skies were so blue they hurt his eyes. A breeze blew through the trees, and the air was scented by leaves and grasses sweet with summer warmth. It was the sort of day when you felt that anything was possible. He sat down in the space he had occupied the night before, where the tree had first spoken to him, studied it for a time, then lay down beneath it and closed his eyes. He gave himself time to relax, then turned his thoughts to his aunt, to the Ard Rhys and her imprisonment inside the forbidding, embracing the fear such thoughts automatically generated, and waited.
Penderyn.
Tanaquil.
You must have what you came for. You must take what you need.
What of giving you a part of myself? What of that?
You must do so.
He couldn't help himself. Will I be crippled?
You will be enhanced.
A part of me will be missing?
A part of you will be found.
There was no way to make sense of what he was being told. Penn could not decide if he was about to make a good or a bad decision. He could not read the consequences clearly.
Are you afraid?
Yes.
Fear for yourself has no place in what you would do. Your fear must be for your aunt if you are to save her. A dark wand is born of fear for another's safety. A dark wand responds to selfless need. Do you wish to save your aunt?
He swallowed hard. I do.
Then no sacrifice is too great, even that of your own life.
Is that what is required?
What is required should not matter. Do you wish to proceed?
He took a deep, steadying breath. Did he? How great a risk was he taking? Things weren't working out the way he had expected. The King of the Silver River had told him he must persuade the Tanaquil to his cause. But the Tanaquil didn't seem interested in being persuaded to anything. It seemed to have already made its decision, and what mattered now was how far Penn was willing to go to allow that decision to be implemented. It was like being trapped in a cave with no light and having to find his way in darkness. There must be pits into which he could fall, and he had no way of knowing where they were.
Do you wish me to give you what you came for, Penderyn?
He closed his eyes. I do.
Then rise and come to me. Walk to me and place your hands on my body.
He opened his eyes and saw that the tiny roots had withdrawn once more, then rose and moved over to stand before the tree. Gingerly, he pressed his palms against its massive, rough trunk.
Climb up into me.
He found handholds in the bark and began to climb. It was easier than he would have expected. The bark was strong and did not break off. The effort was considerable, but eventually he reached the lower branches and from there was able to continue on up through the sprawl of limbs as if climbing a ladder. He wasn't sure how high he was supposed to go, and so kept looking for some indication of where he was to stop. But he was deep within the canopy of the tree, its leaves forming a thick curtain about him, before it spoke to him again.
Stop.
He stopped climbing and looked around. He was at a junction of branches where deep fissures had split the tree's trunk, forming crevices and boles in which birds or small animals might nest. The fissures were old, and in the wounds that had healed, the skin had grown back over the soft heartwood, The bark wrapped about the openings anew.
"Look up."
He did so, turning his gaze skyward to the sea of limbs and leaves that spread away overhead.
"Reach up."
He did this, too, and his hand touched a limb that extended some 6 feet from the trunk, a limb that seemed too small and straight, that lacked twigs or even leaves. Heat radiated from the branch, sudden and unexpected, and Penn jerked away in surprise.
"Take hold."
Penn gripped the branch tentatively, feeling the heat course through his fingers and down his arm. The branch was vibrating, humming deeply as it did so, a strange, mournful sound. Then the entire tree shook, and its trunk split apart where the branch sprouted, a sharp rending that sent pieces of bark and splinters of wood flying in all directions. Penn ducked his head and closed his eyes, keeping tight hold of the branch, rocking unsteadily with the tentacles quaking. There was a deep, audible groan of darkest protest, and abruptly the branch came away in Penn's hands. The boy caught himself against the trunk and stared in shock. The tree had cracked wide open where the branch had broken off, and sap was leaking out in a steady stream. The sap was red and viscous and looked like blood. It ran down the trunk in thick rivulets. It dripped from the branch onto his arm. He was studying it, his left hand braced against the tree for support, his fingers gripping one of the older splits, when the tree groaned again, deep and menacing, and the split closed over his fingers. He screamed in agony and jerked away, feeling flesh and bone tear free as he did so. He reacted at once, but was still too slow. When he stared down at his hand, he saw that his middle two fingers had been severed at the first knuckle. Blood dripped from the ragged wounds and ran down his hand. His finger bones shone white and raw. Still clutching the tentacle's severed limb, Penn collapsed into a crook in the branches of the tree, pressing his injured hand against his chest, staining his clothing with his blood. For a moment, frozen by pain and shock, he couldn't move. Then, realizing the danger as his blood continued to well up, he tore free one sleeve of his tunic and wrapped the cloth about the stubs, compressing it into the wounds.
"A part of you for a part of me."
Penn nodded miserably. He didn't need to be reminded. The pain ratcheting through his hand and arm was reminder enough.
"Take my limb in your hand."
Holding his shirt-sleeve-wrapped fingers tightly against his chest, he reached down with his right hand and took the tentacle's limb from his lap, where he had dropped it moments before. To his surprise, it was still warm and pulsating, as if it retained life, even though it had been severed from the tree.
"The wood of this limb comes from deep inside me, where my life is formed. The limb must be forced to the surface from the soft heartwood and forcibly severed. Such a sacrifice is necessary if a dark wand is to be shaped to the use you require. But you must give back what you are given if the sacrifice is to have value. A piece of your body. A piece of your heart. Remember this."
Penn closed his eyes and exhaled slowly. The loss of his fingers in exchange for the loss of the tentacle's limb, he wasn't likely to forget.
"Climb down from me. Carry my limb with you."
Penn cautiously made his way down from the tree, protecting his injured hand as he did so, cradling the limb in the crook of his arm. It was a long, tedious descent, and when he was still 10 feet from the ground, he slipped and fell, striking the earth with force and jarring his hand. Fresh pain caused him to cry out. He was sweating heavily as he dragged himself to his feet and leaned back against the ancient trunk. His fingers throbbed, and the fabric wrapping them was soaked with his blood. He felt nauseous and weak.
"Move away from me and sit."
He lurched from the tree and found the patch of ground he had occupied before. He dropped heavily, crossed his legs before him, and bent his head to the earth as he felt everything begin to spin. He glimpsed the Tanaquil's root tendrils as they reemerged and began to stroke his clothing and boots. He pulled back his pant legs so that the roots could find his skin, so that the tree could make contact with him. He reached out with his own hand to touch them.
"Unwrap your fingers. Take the sap from the end of my limb and place it on your wounds."
Pen hesitated, then unwound the soiled cloth. The stubs of his fingers were red and inflamed, and blood was still leaking from them. He used his good hand to gather sap still oozing from the end of the Tanaquil's limb, and he rubbed it gingerly into his wounds. Almost instantly, they began to close, the bleeding to stop, and the flesh to heal. The pain, so intense only moments earlier, faded to a dull ache. He stared at his fingers in disbelief.
"Take the knife from your belt."
He did so, frightened anew of what would be asked of him.
"Close your eyes."
Again, he did so.
"You must shape the dark wand now, while the life of the wood is still strong."
He waited. He could not begin to carve the wood until he could see how to do so. He must be permitted to open his eyes. But no command to open them came. Instead, the nature of the touching changed, and communication that had come in the form of words now came in the form of images. He saw in his mind what he was meant to do, a clear and unmistakable direction. Then, something odd happened. He felt another hand on his, covering it, guiding it, and his own began to move in response. By feel alone, he began the cutting that would shape the limb into the dark wand. He should have been terrified that he would make a mistake. The cuts were often tiny and intricate. They were impossibly time-consuming. But the images were so clear, and his sense of what was needed so strong, that he never wavered in his efforts. And time did not seem to matter. It was as if time had stopped, and he could use it in whatever manner or measure he deemed necessary to accomplish his task. He worked through the remainder of the day and into the night. He did not eat or drink. He did not move from where he sat. His concentration was complete as he responded to the tree's steady, calm commands. Nothing distracted him, not the tiny itch of an insect's wings or the cool whisper of a breeze against his skin. He was in another world, another time, another life. It was night when he finished, the moon risen and the stars come out, their light falling through the forest canopy in pale, thin streamers, the darkness about him deep and pervasive. The images stopped, the roots withdrew back into the earth, and he was alone in the silence. He opened his eyes and looked down at his lap. The dark wand lay cradled in his hands, its 6-foot length a rich, mottled gray and black, the same colors as the Tanaquil's trunk, gleaming and smooth in a way that should have been impossible for newly carved wood. An intricate pattern of runes wrapped its surface, strange markings that Pen did not recognize and could not interpret. When they were turned to the moonlight, they gleamed as if lit by an inner fire. Pen could still feel unmistakable warmth emanating from the wood, the Tanaquil's life force firm and strong. The boy unfolded his legs, which were cramped and sore. His mouth was so dry he could barely open it. He took a few minutes to gather his strength, then got to his feet and began hobbling toward the pool that Cinnaminson had showed him earlier. He carried the dark wand with him, He knew he would carry it everywhere from then on. Slowly, his legs regained their feeling and the cramps disappeared. He listened for signs of life as he walked, but there were none. Even as long as he had been sitting beneath the tree, he was still alone. He wondered suddenly what had happened to Cinnaminson. She had told him she would come back to him at nightfall. She had promised. He found the pool and dropped down on his hands and knees to drink. The water was cool and sweet, and he got back a little of his strength. When he had drunk his fill, he stood up again and looked around. Where was Cinnaminson? He exhaled in frustration. He didn't like it that she was still gone. He never liked it when she was gone. Losing her was worse than losing his fingers. He stopped himself, remembering suddenly the sensation of another's hand guiding his as he shaped the Tanaquil's limb into the dark wand, one that allowed him to work blindly, his eyes closed, his reliance on touch alone. A piece of your body, a piece of your heart. A terrible certainty swept through him, harsh and implacable, so traumatizing that he could not give voice to it, but only whisper it in the silence of his mind. He thought he had understood. He hadn't. He assumed that the loss of his fingers was enough to balance the scales. It wasn't. Something more was required. Cinnaminson. Chapter 25. Shadea Aru stood at the window of her sleeping chambers and looked out from Paranor's towers over the forested sweep of the land beyond. The sun was rising, a soft golden glow in the east that silhouetted the jagged peaks of the Dragon's Teeth against its bright backdrop and gave promise to the coming of a warm, languorous summer day. Her lips compressed into a tight, angry line. It would not be such a good day for her, and less so for some others. She glanced down at the note she held in her hand, at the words written on it, then looked away again. Idiots! She brushed absently at her short, spiky blonde hair and flexed her shoulders. Her muscles were stiff and tight. She missed the training and fighting that had been so central to her life when she had been a soldier in the Federation Army. She missed the discipline and the routine. She had never thought she would feel that way, but after weeks of struggling as Ard Rhys of the Third Druid Order, she was ready to abandon it all for a chance to go back to a time when things were less complicated and more direct. Her gaze drifted back to the note. It had arrived during the night while she slept, and she had found it on waking, tied to the leg of the Arrow Swift. The bird's dark, fierce face had peered out at her from its enclosure, almost daring her to reach inside. But it was her bird, one of the many she had appropriated and trained to carry her messages from her co-conspirators and servants in the plot against Grion Olmsford. Its countenance only mirrored the intensity that could be found in her own. She knew the bird. Split was its name, chosen for the strange wedge in its tail feathers, an accident of birth. The Arrow Swift was one of those assigned to Trant Rowan on his departure to the Northland. It had been sent by him. She had reached inside for the message, untied it from Split's leg, withdrawn it from the cage, opened it, and her face had gone dark with rage immediately. The boy and his companions escaped from Taupo Ruff, have followed them into the clue. And lost them there, of course, though the writer had been careful not to say so. She looked back at the message again, still furious with its contents and its incompetent sender. She had expected better of Trant Rowan. She had expected better of Pyson Wentz as well, and better still of the two of them working together to track that boy. She gritted her teeth. Why was it so difficult for anyone to find and hold him? The effort had cost Tarek Molt his life. It had cost Aphasia Y her respect, a respect she had thought nothing could diminish. What would it cost her this time? The lives of two more of her allies, men whose support she could scarcely afford to lose, even if they were proving less competent than she had imagined possible? Her respect for them had long since vanished, so there was no danger of losing that. She crumpled the note in her hand, then set it in a small bowl on her desk, fired it with magic, and scattered the ashes out the window. She watched the breeze carry the ashes away, and wished her anger and disappointment could be made to vanish as easily. What was she going to have to do to finish this business? For a moment, for just an instant, she toyed with the idea of breaking off the hunt entirely. It was requiring much more time and effort than she cared to spend, and netting no favorable results at all. She had the boy's parents safely locked away in her dungeons. Couldn't she just wait for him to come for them? He would surely do so, once he found out where they were, and it would be easy enough to make him aware. Her frustration building toward a headache, she rubbed at her temples with her fingers. The trouble with ignoring him was that she was almost certain she knew what he was doing. He was trying to find a way to reach his aunt. She had no idea how he planned to do that, and believed it beyond his or anyone else's capability. But she could not chance being wrong. If he had found a way into the forbidding, if he had discovered an avenue about which she knew nothing, then she had to stop him from using it. Because if he managed the impossible and actually reached Grion Olmsford from Paranor's side of the wall, he might find a way to guide her back again. If that happened, Shadea knew she was finished. They were all finished, all who had conspired with her. The chance of that happening was so small that it was scarcely measurable, but she knew better than to put anything past the Olmsfords. Their history spoke for itself. They had survived impossible situations before, several generations of them. They were imbued with both magic and luck, and the combination had kept them from harm more times than anyone could count. She could not afford to allow that to happen again. So she would leave things as they were. She would allow Trant Rowan and Pison Wentz to continue to hunt down the boy. Perhaps Aphasia Y still tracked him as well, even though she had heard nothing from her assassin in days. One never knew about that creature. One could never predict. The ashes of the burned note were gone, turned to dust, and blown away. She breathed in the morning air, calming herself, reassuring herself that everything was going to be all right. In the next few days, she would journey to Ardashaig to meet with Sen Dunsadan. The Prime Minister was seeking her support for a sustained assault on the Freeborn, a course of action on which they had already tacitly agreed, but had yet to act. The Federation required the backing of the Druids if they were to succeed in their plans to break the stalemate on the Precandoran and advance into Callahorn. The Prime Minister needed to know that Shadea, as head of the Druid Order, would not act to stop him. She, in turn, needed to know that he would continue to support her as Ard Rhys. She was less concerned about his backing than she had been at the beginning, when her support was so small and her position as acting Ard Rhys so tenuous. But things had changed. Once she'd bedded Garen Sera and made him her consort, she began working to gain the support of his followers as well. One by one, using promises and threats, she had subverted them. Even though Sera still thought of himself as leader of his own faction, she had long since replaced him in that position. She glanced at the rumpled bed to one side and grimaced. She had played at that game long enough. She had allowed him enough liberties. It was time to put an end to it. It was time to toss him from her bed and from her life. Intent on going out to confer with a handful of those on whom she believed she could depend, she threw off her nightclothes and dressed in her druid robes. Matters would get rough before the day was out, and she must know who would stand with her when they did. She knew better than to leave such things to chance. Wrapped in her black garments, Her chain of office hung about her neck. She was moving toward the chamber door when it burst open and Garin Sera strode through, his hatchet face dark with anger.
"We have been betrayed, Shadea," he announced without preamble.
He flung off his robe and threw himself down in one of the cushioned chairs.
"By the very ally you were so confident would not dare to do so."
She stared at him. "Send Dunsadan?" A sneer twisted his lean face.
"Send Dunsadan. Last night, the elves launched an airship strike against his army. The strike failed because the Federation forces knew about it in advance and were waiting. They have invented a weapon that produces a light beam of such intensity and power that it can burn an airship right out of the sky. It did so in response to the attack, destroying virtually the entire elven fleet before the Federation airship that bore it was damaged and had to set down."
He leaned forward.
"But that was just the beginning. During the airship battle, the Federation army attacked the elven defensive lines and broke through. The elves were driven right off the Precandoran. They might still be running for all I know. Their allies are trying to hang on, but they're surrounded. I wouldn't give them much chance."
He shook his head in disgust.
"So tell me, Shadea, what do you think of your precious Prime Minister now?"
His sharp eyes fixed on her.
"You didn't know about this attack beforehand, did you? I would hate to think you were keeping things from me."
She hadn't known a thing about it, of course. She was as surprised by the news as he was, but there was no reason for her to tell him so. Better that he thought her one step ahead of him. "There was some discussion about it. I hadn't thought he intended to act so quickly."
"It would have been nice if you had told me."
She shrugged. "We both keep some things to ourselves, Garand. Don't pretend otherwise. As I said, I hadn't thought he was going to do this until later. Apparently, an opportunity presented itself that he couldn't afford to pass up. We can hardly begrudge him that."
Garin Sera frowned. "I don't like it that he's acted without seeking our approval. It will look to everyone as if he no longer cares whether we stand with him or against him. It will look as if he considers our support irrelevant."
Just so, she was thinking. Sen Dunsadan would have to be called to account once she was able to confront him. It might be that it was time for her to end their relationship in a way that left no doubt as to who was the real power in the Four Lands. "This weapon," she said, changing the subject. "It doesn't sound like anything I've ever heard of. It sounds as if it employs a form of magic."
Garin Sera shook his head in disagreement. "The Prime Minister doesn't have the use of magic."
"Perhaps he has acquired the aid of someone who does." Her eyes locked on his. "One of us."
He snorted. "Who? Who would want to give aid to Sen Dunsadan, knowing that you would view it as a—"
He stopped himself.
"Are you thinking of Iridia?"
"Do we know where she is? Did we ever find out where she went after she left here?"
Sera shook his head slowly. "No. But she wouldn't dare to betray us. She knows what would happen if she did."
She cringed at his use of the word "us," at the implication that he was somehow a part of the decision-making process, when in fact he was little more than another obstacle. She glanced away to hide her disgust, then turned and walked to the window. She stood there for a moment, thinking.
"What do you intend to do?"
he asked, rising and coming over to put his hands on her shoulders. She felt the strength of those hands as they gripped her. They were possessive and commanding as they turned her about to face him. They suggested in no uncertain terms that he was the one in control. She smiled agreeably as he leaned down and kissed her mouth. She kissed him back, waited for the kiss to end, then broke away. "I intend to drink my morning cup of tea before speaking with those in the Order who will keep an eye on things in our absence." He stared after her.
"Our absence? Are we going somewhere?
To confront Sen Dunsadan, of course. She had told him nothing of her plans to visit Ardashaig before this. The reason was simple. She had not intended for him to go. She still didn't, but it was best to let him think she did.
To confront him? In his own home, his own city, surrounded by his own people?
Garen Sarah considered the prospect.
A bold course of action, Shadea. How safe can we expect to be?
She shrugged, pouring tea into cups, slipping into his the tiny pill she had been saving for that moment, and watching it dissolve instantly. We are druids, Garand. We can't afford to worry about being safe. We can't afford to be seen, to be afraid. She handed him his tea, stood in front of him as she sipped from her own, and watched with satisfaction as he drank. Sit with me on the bed. She took his arm and moved over. She pulled him down next to her. Perhaps we needn't go down right away. The tea is making me warm all over. I need to find a way to cool off. She smiled and sipped again. Come, Garand. Finish your tea. Don't keep me waiting. He drank it in a single gulp and reached for her. His appetites were so pathetic, so predictable. She eased away, playfully. He was still grinning when the drug took effect. An abrupt change came over his hatchet features. His face went slack and empty, and he lurched forward, falling onto his side. That was quick, she thought. She rose and looked down at him, at the way his eyes rolled frantically from side to side as he tried to understand what was happening to him. She eased a pillow under his head, then reached for his legs and lifted them onto the bed so that he was lying, stretched out along its length. Comfortable, Garand? Much better to rest while this is happening. Knowing he could no longer reach for her, could no longer move at all for that matter, she bent over him. His lungs and his heart still worked, but not very efficiently. He barely had the strength of a baby. I've given you a drug, she explained, sitting next to him. It saps the strength from your muscles and leaves you paralyzed. It only lasts a little while. There is no trace of its presence afterwards. Unlike poison, for example, which I considered using but decided against. After all, I can't afford to be seen as a murderess. She leaned close. You see what is to happen, I expect. Your eyes tell me you know. So now you no longer love me. Now you despise me. Love is like that. It only lasts for as long as both parties require it, and then it becomes a burden, which is one reason I do not permit myself to love anyone too much. You should have learned that lesson a long time ago. I am surprised you didn't. Now you must learn it the hard way. He was staring fixedly at her, and she read the hatred in his eyes. In contrast, his face was empty of expression, and it seemed as if the eyes must belong to someone else. Yet the eyes were really all that was left of him. Everything else had been stripped away by the drug. She leaned down and kissed him lightly on the forehead. Try not to think too harshly of me, Garand. You would have done the same if you had paid closer attention to how I looked at you. Then she took the pillow from under his head, placed it firmly over his face, and pressed down on it with all of her considerable strength until he stopped breathing. When the cell door closed and the locking bolts were thrown, Beck Ohmsford was engulfed in blackness. He sat down, waiting for his eyes to adjust, and after a time they did. A sliver of light crept under the door and through the seams on the latch side, permitting him just enough illumination to find his way around. The cell was tiny, and it didn't take him long to explore it. He found nothing that would help. The walls, floor, and ceiling were hewn from bedrock, and the only exit was through the barred door. The room contained only the bed, straw, and bucket he had seen upon being brought in. There were no implements that might be used for tunneling or prying. There were no fissures or seams on which to employ such a tool in any event. And there was nothing he could use for a weapon. He sat on the bed and thought about his situation for a long time. If Shadea was to be believed, and he had no reason to assume she wasn't, there was a guard stationed on the other side of the door, watching for any attempt at escape. Down the hall and up the stairs, there would be others. A relay was in place to send word faster than he could run should he attempt to break free. He couldn't know all the particulars, but he had to assume the guards had a form of communication that would allow them to know if one or more of their number had been overpowered. Time passed, and eventually the door opened far enough to permit a gnome hunter to slide a tray of food inside before the locks were thrown anew. Accustomed by then to the dark, Beck was blinded by the sudden glare of torchlight and barely caught a glimpse of what was happening before the door was closed again. He took that into account as he continued to make his plans, sitting on the floor of his cell and eating his meal. The food, he found, was reasonable. Apparently, Shadea didn't intend to do away with him through starvation. But he hadn't changed his mind that she intended to do away with him in some manner. He waited through three more meals, measuring the time it took the gnome to pull back the lock bolt, open the cell door, slide the food tray inside, close the door, and throw the bolt again. It was clear to him that any escape would have to come then. It would not be possible to escape if he had to break down or lever open the door. The noise such an effort would require, even if time and opportunity allowed for it, would alert the gnome hunters immediately, and any chance of surprise would be lost. Even then, once he was through, what would he find on the other side? At least one gnome hunter. But how many more would be keeping him company? If he were Shadea, he would insist on at least two, possibly more, being present any time the cell door was opened. That would eliminate the chance that he could successfully overpower one guard without alerting the others. He began positioning himself so that he could see something of the hallway outside when the cell door was cracked, and through two further meals he tried to catch a glimpse of what was out there. But it was impossible to see more than a little of what lay beyond, never enough to be certain. He did catch sight of movement once, a shadow thrown by torchlight that indicated the presence of another man. But it was clear that he would have to make his break into the hallway without knowing how many gnomes he would find. How could he do that and still make certain they could not sound the alarm? He puzzled it through with an increasing sense of desperation. He needed to find a solution quickly because time was slipping away, and with it, his chances of freeing Rue and warning Penderin. In spite of what Shadea had learned of Taupo Ruff, he had to assume that his son was still free and his exact whereabouts still undiscovered. But that could change in a hurry. He decided in the end that what he must do was use the wish song in a blanket assault, stunning everyone within hearing distance and giving him a chance to get up the steps to confront whomever he had missed. It was a long shot at best, one he did not much care to take. But sitting in his cell and waiting for the inevitable was madness. He hated putting Rue at risk, but he knew that she would want him to if it meant giving them a chance, however slim, of reaching Penn. He decided to try for one more look, using the next feeding as a trial run for determining exactly where he should stand to get through the door to the guards. He waited patiently, using his time to run repeated rehearsals of what he would do, working and reworking his timing, his movements, everything that would be required of him. When the door finally opened, he was standing just to the open side, watching the movements of the gnome hunter as he knelt to slide the food tray inside, counting the seconds from the time the door opened until it closed again. It took 12 seconds. He would have to act quickly. he would have to summon the wish song and hold it within himself until the locks were thrown. Then he would have to sprint through the door, directing the magic down the hallway as he emerged, a quick and certain strike. He sat in the darkness and thought about how little chance he had of making this plan work. Wasn't there a better one? Wasn't there something else he could do? He was just finishing his meal when a piece of paper was slid under the door. He stared at it for a moment, then reached down to retrieve it. Bent close to the bottom of the door, where the thin light gave just enough illumination to allow him to make out the words, he read, "Help is coming." Beck recognized the writing immediately. It was the same hand that had penned the note he and Rue had received on their arrival at Paranor, the one that had warned them not to trust anyone. He had never discovered the identity of the writer, and in truth, he had forgotten all about the note until that moment. Lying on the floor next to the crack beneath the cell door, he read it again. Could he believe it? Could he trust that the writer would be able to find a way to free him? How long could he afford to wait to find out? He stared blindly into the darkness of his prison, searching for the answers. Chapter 26. He heard the voices first, soft and insistent, joined as one, humming and then singing, the words indecipherable, but their sound sharp and clear and compelling. "Pendaren," she whispered from out of the confluence. "I've come back." But it wasn't her voice, and he knew that when he looked, it wouldn't be her. It wouldn't be anybody at all. "I said I would come back. I promised, didn't I?" He lay where he had fallen asleep near dawn, exhausted from searching for her after realizing where she might be and what she might have done. Frantic with worry, he had torn through the ancient forest like a madman, plunging through the dark trunks and layered shadows, calling her name until he was too tired to continue. Then, heartsick and drained of hope, he had collapsed. It couldn't be true, he kept telling himself. His suspicions were unfounded and fueled by his weariness and the shock of losing his fingers. It was all a lie of the mind, born of his misinterpretation of the Tanaquil's words, of the fears raised by the tree's dark reminder that its gift of the Dark Wand required a like gift from him. Of the body, of the heart. "Pendaren, wake up! Open your eyes!" But he kept his eyes closed, wrapped in the comforting darkness that not seeing her afforded, unwilling to let that last shred of hope fall away. He moved his damaged hand beneath him, feeling with his good fingers for the ones that were missing, finding the stumps healed over and the pain gone. It wasn't so bad, he supposed, losing parts of two fingers. Not for what he had been given in turn. Not for what it meant to his efforts at finding his aunt. Not for what it meant to the future of the Four Lands. It wasn't so bad. But losing Cinnaminson was. "Why did you do it?" he asked finally, his voice so soft that he could barely hear his own words. Silence greeted his query, a long and empty sweep of time in which the voices grew quiet, and the sounds of the forest slowly filled the void their departure created. "Why, Cinnaminson?" Still no answer. Suddenly fearful that he had lost her completely, he lifted his head and looked around. He was alone, sprawled on the grassy patch on which he had fallen asleep the night before, the Dark Wand resting on the ground beside him, its glossy length shimmering, its carved runes dark and mysterious. "Cinnaminson," he called. "It was a chance for me to be something I couldn't otherwise be," she spoke to him from out of the air. "I am free from my body pen,
free from my blindness, free in a way I could never be otherwise. I can fly everywhere. I can see what I could never see before. Not in the way I do now. I am not alone anymore. I have found a family. I have sisters. I have a mother and father.
He didn't know what to say. She sounded so happy, but her happiness made him feel miserable. He hated himself for his reaction, but he couldn't find a way to change it.
"It was your choice to do this?" he demanded, his words sounding woeful and plaintive, even to him.
"Of course, Penderyn. Do you think I was forced to become one of them? It was my choice to shed my body."
"But you knew I wouldn't be given the Tanaquil's branch any other way, didn't you?"
"I knew it was the right thing to do. Just as you did when you agreed to come here to find the tree and to seek help in freeing your aunt."
"But you knew," he persisted, desperate to wring from her one small concession. "You knew that becoming an Eread would help me. You knew that giving yourself to the Tanaquil was what it would take for the Tanaquil to give me its limb." Her hesitation was momentary.
"I knew."
She was moving all around him, a part of the ether, a disembodied voice buttressed by the soft singing and humming of her sister Ereads, her new family, her new life. He tried to see her in the sound of her voice, but he could not quite manage it. His memory of her was strong, but his efforts to form a picture from her voice alone were insufficient. He didn't want her back in still life. He wanted her back as a living, breathing human being, and the images he managed to conjure failed to capture her that way. He sank back wearily. "When did you decide to do this?" His voice broke as despair threatened to overwhelm him. "Why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you talk to me about it?" The singing rose and fell like a wave of emotion born on a shift in the wind.
"What would I have said to you? That I love you so much that I cannot imagine life without you, but that I am old enough to understand that loving someone that much isn't always the only measuring stick for making a life with them? That choosing love should never be selfish. If you loved me that much, I love you that much, Penderyn. Nothing has changed. I love you still. But you were sent here for another reason, one too important to sacrifice for anything, even for me. I know this. I knew it from the moment that I heard the Eread speaking to me. They were telling me what was needed, not directly, not in so many words, but in the way they sang to me, in the sound of their voices. I knew."
He shook his head.
"I don't think I can do this without you. I can't even think straight. I can barely move."
Matched by the voices of her sisters, soothing as a breeze on a hot summer day, her voice trilled with soft laughter.
"Oh, Pen, it will pass. You will go on to do what you were sent to do. You will find your aunt and bring her home again. I am already a memory, already fading away."
He stared into space, into the place from where she spoke to him, trying to make himself accept what she was telling him, and failing. The voices sighed and hummed, and sighed some more.
"Do not be sad, Penderyn," she whispered. "I am not sad. I am happy. You can hear it in my voice, can't you? I made a choice. The Ereads asked me to join them, to help you and myself. While you slept, I went with them from the surface of the earth to the down below, from the sunlight and air world of Father Tanaquil to the darkness and earth world of Mother Tanaquil. She roots deep, Pen, to provide for her children, to give them life, to allow them the freedom she can never have. I saw the truth of what she is, of what they both are, joined as one. Father, the limbs, mother, the roots. One lives above ground, but the other must forever live below. She gets lonely. She needs company. I was a gift to her from Father Tanaquil, but it was what I wanted. Perhaps he knew that when he sent me to her. Perhaps he knows us both better than we know ourselves. They are very old spirits, Pen. They were here when the world was born, when the world was still young and the fairy creatures newly made. We are children in their eyes. We are men, he snapped, and they don't know what's right for us. They don't know anything about us because they aren't like us. Don't you see? We were manipulated. We were tricked.
A long silence punctuated his angry words.
No, Pen. We did what we thought was best. Both of us. I don't regret it. I won't. We have the lives we have chosen, whether fate or the Tanaquil or something larger pushed us to that choice.
He took a long, slow breath to calm himself. She was wrong. He knew she was wrong. But there was nothing he could do about it. It was over and done with. He would have to live with it, although he couldn't imagine how he would ever do that.
Did it hurt at all? He asked quietly.
Your transformation. Was there any pain?
None, Pen.
But what of your body? Did it just...
He couldn't finish the thought, unable to bear the image it conjured, an image of her turning to dust, disintegrating. Laughter greeted his failure, gentle and soothing.
Kept safe and unchanging in her arms. I sleep with Mother Tanaquil, Pen, down within the earth, in the darkness and quiet where she takes root. She nourishes me so that I can live. If I were to die, I would cease to exist, even as an Ariad.
She is down in the ravine, he thought suddenly. He was finally beginning to understand. The Tanaquil was both male and female, mother and father to the Ariads, a trunk joining limbs at one end to roots at the other. Cinnaminson was in the keeping of the latter, down in the shadowy depths they had crossed over on the bridge, down where something huge had stirred awake on their passing. But still whole, she was telling him, still alive in human form. Cinnaminson, he said, an idea coming to sudden life, a plan to implement it taking shape. I need to see you again before I go. I need to say goodbye. It isn't enough just to hear your voice. It doesn't feel real to me. Can you take me to where you sleep? There was a long pause.
You cannot have me back, Pen. Mother Tanaquil will not let me go. Not even if you beg.
She recognized his intentions all too well, but his mind was already made up. He was terrified of what he might find if he did it, half certain that she was already reduced to bones and dust, that her vision of herself as still being whole was a subterfuge fostered by the tree. But he couldn't leave without knowing, no matter how devastating the truth, if there was a way to set her free again, to take her with him. I won't do anything but make sure that you are safe, he lied. I just need to see you one last time.
This is a mistake, she trilled,
her voice rising amid those of her sisters, sharp with rebuke.
You shouldn't ask it of me.
He took a deep breath.
But I am asking.
He waited a moment.
Please, Cinnaminson.
The voices of the Ariads hummed, a long, sustained chord that matched the sound of wind whispering through the leaves of trees, soft and resilient. He forced himself to keep silent, to say nothing more, to wait.
I am afraid for you, Pen, she said finally. I am afraid for myself, he admitted.
A pause followed,
and the humming died away. Come with me then, if you must, if you can remember my warning.
He exhaled softly. He was not likely to forget. On the far side of the ravine, Kyber Elysidil stood at the foot of the stone bridge, listening to the soft moan of the wind. She had been standing there for the better part of an hour, using her admittedly unskilled druid senses to scan the forest for sign of Pen and Cinnaminson. It wasn't the first time she had done so, but the results were the same. She might as well have been casting about the blue divide for a sailor lost at sea, for all the good it was doing her. One hand clutched the elf stones. She kept them close on the theory that they might at some point prove useful in her search. They were doing her about as much good as her druid skills. Frustrated, she turned away. She hated feeling so helpless. Ever since the safety lines tied to Pen and Cinnaminson had dropped away as if severed by an invisible blade, she had known that the fate of her friends was out of her hands. More than once, she had considered trying to cross over herself, and she wasn't afraid to try in spite of the warning on the stone. But she didn't want to do anything that would jeopardize Pen's efforts to secure the Dark Wand. She looked back into the gardens, her dazzlingly colorful prison, trapped in all that beauty and unable to enjoy it, her concentration on Pen and on the island and on the druids tracking them and on time running out. Thinking about it all made her want to scream. But there was nothing she could do. Nothing but wait. She stalked over to where Kermadec sat talking with Tagwin, trading stories of the old days when Grion Olmsford was new to the position of Ardris, and they were just beginning in her service. "Do you think there might be another way across?" she asked abruptly, kneeling next to them, her voice urgent. "Another bridge, or a narrows we might vault?" She exhaled sharply. "I don't think I can stand waiting another minute without doing something." Kermadec stared at her impassively.
"There might be. If you want to take a look, you can. I can send Artalan or Barak with you."
She shook her head. "I can manage alone. I just need to do something besides stand around." Tagwin frowned into his beard, but didn't say anything.
"You won't lose your way, will you, elven girl?"
the matter impressed.
"I wouldn't want to have to come looking for you."
"I can find my way."
"If you discover anything, you will come back and tell us?"
Tagwin pressed suddenly. "Yes, yes," she snapped. "I'm not going to do anything rash or foolish." Her irritation got the better of her for a moment, and she took a deep breath. "I just want to see if that ravine goes all the way around, or if there are other places to cross. I won't attempt anything on my own." She didn't know if they believed her or not, but if they did, they ought to be less trusting. She fully intended to attempt a crossing if a place to make one could be found. She should have gone with Pen and Cinnaminson in the first place, but she had allowed her instincts to be overruled. She stood up, giving them a bright smile. "I don't expect to be gone long. I probably won't get much beyond what we can see from standing right here. But it will make me feel better to have tried." Their eyes fixed on her, as if searching for the truth beyond her words. Neither replied. She turned away quickly and started off, choosing to go south, where the gardens opened out toward a thinning woods and a set of hills. She could see the ravine as it snaked its way into those hills, disappearing finally into the horizon. In truth, she didn't have much hope that she would succeed in her quest. She mostly hoped that the distraction would help with the waiting. She was so intent on her efforts to get clear of the others that she failed to detect, with her normally reliable druid training, the shadowy form lying in wait directly ahead. She missed it entirely as it slipped away at her approach and circled back around toward the bridge. Pen Olmsford followed the low, vibrant humming of the Aeriads as they led him on through the trees
and back toward the dark cut of the ravine, the light casting his shadow before him as he walked. He could measure the direction they were taking from the slant of the sun's thin rays through the heavy canopy. He tried to hear Cinnaminson in the mix of Ariad voices, but he could not detect a noticeable difference in any of them. She was being assimilated into their order, and he could not stop himself from thinking that if he did not reach her soon, there would be no way to separate her from the others, even if her body was still intact. Thinking of her body at rest beneath the earth, in the cradle of the Tanaquil's roots, made him wonder about the condition of the bodies of the other Ariads. For their spirits to survive in Ariad form, their bodies must be kept whole as well. But how was that accomplished? He was feeling less and less certain about what it was he was going to find. He was starting to think that his request was a mistake. Yet he kept on, drawn by the humming, by the promise it offered that he might still find a way to bring Cinnaminson back to him. Both hands gripped the polished length of the dark wand, the only weapon he possessed aside from his long knife. The dark wand was a talisman of magic meant to be used to breach the wall of the forbidding. But it had come from the wood of the tree. Could it be used to penetrate the tangle of the Tanaquil's roots? Could it be employed in some way to free the rover girl? It was wishful thinking, seductive and empty of promise. There was nothing to suggest the dark wand would do him the slightest bit of good in his effort to bring Cinnaminson out of the ravine. But it was all he had to rely on, and so even in the face of the patent improbability of it helping him, he held out hope that it would. Time slipped away. He was beginning to lose his sense of direction as the tree limbs tightened overhead and the light faded to a dull wash. But the voices stayed strong, the humming steady, and so he persevered, his determination unshaken. Now and again, he thought to call out to Cinnaminson, to reassure himself that she was still there. But he restrained himself from doing so, knowing that it suggested a weakness in himself he did not want to acknowledge. Eventually, the ground began to slope, then to drop sharply, and the dark crease of the ravine loomed ahead through the trees. As the trilling of the Ariads intensified, Penn felt his hopes sink further. There was unmistakable joy and expectation in those voices. Tightening his grip on the dark wand, he followed the singing to a narrow trail that led downward. The brush and trees a concealing wall, the trail was invisible from anywhere but where he stood. He descended slowly, tracking the trail's switchbacks, keeping close to the ravine wall so he would not slip. One glance down revealed that if he was to do so, he could fall a long way. As he went deeper, the light grew ever more faint until everything was shrouded in gloom. Spots of iridescence given off by organisms growing on the plant life began to shimmer softly in the enfolding darkness. The ravine had the feel of a maw, its dark, wet earth sprouting jagged rocks that jutted like teeth. "I am a fool to come here," he thought. Yet he continued, unwilling to accept that the danger he faced might be too great or the consequences of his effort too terrible. Would Cinnaminson lead him to his doom, even in her newly adopted form? He could not make himself believe so. No, he decided after considering the possibility, she would keep him safe. She would take him to Mother Tanaquil. She would do as he had asked, and he would have his chance to free her. Then the trail ended, and he was at the bottom of the ravine. A vast tangle of roots stretched away before him. The smallest of them were closest, some no larger than strands of human hair. The largest were farther back, barely visible through the enfolding darkness and the pale wash of diffused sunlight, and many were thicker than his body. They lay in twisted heaps, loose and coiled, half emerged from the earth in which they had buried themselves. Penn drew to a halt, uncertain about what to do next. All around him now, and no longer moving forward, the Areads hummed and sang. He glanced about for help, but there was no help to be found. He had gotten as far as he was going to get without doing something on his own, and he had no idea what that something should be. Cinnaminson, he called softly. Ahead, the tree roots shifted, and in their slow grating and scraping, he heard the sound of his own death. Like snakes, they were coiling and uncoiling in anticipation of wrapping about him, of squeezing him until there was no breath left in his body. He felt himself begin to shake as the image eroded his courage, and he tightened his grip once more on the dark wand. Cinnaminson! He called again, louder. As if in response to his cry, the tree roots parted where their wall was thickest, and he saw, revealed in the pale trickle of sunlight and tiny flashes of iridescence, the bodies of dozens of young girls. Thousands of tiny roots wrapped about them, cradling them in nests of dark, earth-fed fiber, their ends attached to the exposed skin where clothing had rotted and fallen away. Their eyes and mouths were closed, and they appeared to be deep in sleep, locked in dreams that he could only imagine. They must have been breathing, but he was too far away to be certain. Then he saw Cinnaminson. She was off to one side, in an area in which the tendrils had not yet grown so thick, and her body was still mostly exposed and unfettered. She slept the sleep of the others, and most probably dreamed their dreams. But her place among them was newer, her coming clearly more recent. He didn't stop to think about what he should do. He simply started toward her, compelled by his determination to get close enough to touch her, and by doing so, to wake her and then to free her. He didn't know how he would manage it, or even if he could. He only knew he had to try. "Penn, no!" Cinnaminson cried out, her voice separating suddenly from those of the other Areads. Instantly, the Tanaquil's roots began to shift, the rasp and scrape of fiber on earth and stone so menacing that Penn froze in mid-stride and brought the dark wand up like a shield. The wall had reformed in front of him, barring him from getting any closer, telling him in no uncertain terms that he had transgressed. Tendrils stroked the exposed skin of his hands as the tree roots closest to him lifted out of the earth. In his mind, he could hear a hiss of warning, a sound so soft it was like the rustle of sand on old wood. "Don't come any closer." It was the sound of a serpent's tongue sliding from a scaly mouth. "Go back to where you came from."
"Please, Penn," he heard Cinnaminson whisper. "Please, go away. Leave me where I am."
He wanted to ignore the warning, to go to her, to reach out to what was still real and substantive about her, to free her of that nightmare. The Tanaquil had given her the boundless world of an unfettered spirit, of the Areads for whom it provided such freedom, but it was feeding on her as well. He could tell that much just from looking. Did she realize that? Did she understand what was happening to her? But he sensed, even as he asked these questions, that it didn't matter what she knew or how she might respond to knowing. What mattered was that she was content. She was the tree's captive, a slave to the roots that formed its feminine half, and they were not about to let her go for any reason. If he tried to take her, he would be killed. Then no one would know what had happened to her, and no one would ever come to set her free. He closed his eyes against what he was thinking, against his feelings of frustration and helplessness. He should do something. But there was nothing he could do. He had lost her all over again.
"Goodbye, Pendaren,"
he heard her say to him. Her voice rose and fell to blend with the voices of the other Ereads before finally disappearing into them completely. Then the voices faded entirely, and she was gone.
Cinnaminson.
Aware of the sudden silence, he stood, staring into space. Even the tree roots had gone still. Their tangled lengths lay limp and unmoving before him, a wall that he must breach. But he lacked the means to do so. He looked down at the dark wand, wondering anew if it might provide him the magic that was needed. But the purpose of the talisman was to help him gain access to Grion Ohmsford, not to Cinnaminson. The dark wand could breach the wall of the forbidding, but not the wall of the Tanaquil's roots. Nothing had happened to suggest otherwise. No magic had surfaced when his passage through the roots had been denied. No magic had emerged to help him. His throat tightened as he realized that there was nothing more he could do. He would have to abandon his hopes of freeing her. He would have to leave her where she was. He would have to take the Dark Wand and travel to Paranor. He would have to attempt to cross over into the Forbidding and rescue the Ard Rhys. Cinnaminson had given herself to the Tanaquil so that he might do so. What was the point of her sacrifice if he failed to take advantage of it? But it meant risking the possibility that he might never have a chance to come back for her. He closed his eyes and took a deep breath.
"Goodbye,"
he said softly to the darkness. Then he turned away, walked back to the trail that had brought him down into the ravine, and began to climb. Chapter 27. The hand shook him gently awake, and Drummondoon's familiar voice whispered,
"Captain, they're coming."
The Federation army preparing to attack. Pied Sanderling opened his eyes to dawn's faint glow on the eastern horizon, scanned the maze of hills and ravines that surrounded him, and waited for the buzzing in his ears to quiet. Every muscle and joint in his body ached, but he couldn't very well complain. He was lucky to be alive at all. He closed his eyes again, remembering. The explosion of fire rocking the Asashiel, sweeping away railguns and deck crew. The plummet of the craft toward the earth as he clung to his safety line and called in vain for Markenstall. The impact of the airship as it slammed into a grove of wide-limbed conifers, breaking them apart, leaving him hanging from their shattered boughs. Miraculously, in one piece. No broken bones or severed limbs, and no cuts or slashes deep enough to bleed him dry while he waited to be found. And found he had been, almost at once, by Elven Homeguard in retreat from the airfield, who had watched his vessel fall out of the sky. His own troops, who had recognized him instantly and cut him down, pleading with him not to die, begging him to hold on until they could get help. He had been half delirious then, burned and shocked, fighting demons that he imagined still flew overhead and hunted him as a hawk would a mouse seeking refuge where there was none to be found. He had come around eventually, sometime during the long nighttime retreat, through the cut to the hills north of the Precandoran, getting his first good look at the ragtag condition of his valiant home guard. Obedient to his orders, abandoned by Elven army regulars, they had stood alone against the hordes of Federation attackers that had swept across the airfield. The home guard had tried to hold their position, a hopeless task that, in the end, had failed. He had learned this much from Drummondoon, who had found him somehow during the night and stayed with him. He had learned as well that the Elven sector of the Precandoran was lost, and that the Freeborn allies, besieged on three sides, were in danger of being overrun. The battle was still being fought, a mix of bordermen, dwarves, and mercenaries fighting under the command of the charismatic dwarf Vaden Wick. But disheartened by the death of their king, broken by the swiftness of their defeat, the elves had abandoned the field.
"We need you, Captain,"
Drum had hissed at him, bent close so that only Pied could hear.
"We need you desperately."
Pied could not quite understand why his aide was saying that. There was no longer anything he could do. He was a captain of the Home Guard, relieved of his command, reprimanded and humiliated by his king in a way that left no doubt about his future. Nothing could change that, especially with Kellan Elisadil dead and the elven army scattered to the four winds. But that was just the point, Drum had said. Kellan Elisadil was dead, and so was everyone who had heard him dismiss Pied as captain of the Home Guard. The whole incident might never have happened, and in truth, it would be best if everyone thought it hadn't. Look at how matters stood. Stow Fraxon, who commanded the Elven Army regulars, was dead, killed in the Federation assault during the night. All of the airship commanders were dead. Most of the other commanders were scattered or lost. Of all Elven army units assigned to the Precandoran, only the Home Guard was still intact, and only Pied Sanderling was still with his command.
"We have Elven hunters coming in from all over, Captain," Drum whispered. "They think you are their only hope, the only commander of the only unit still making a stand. Think about it. If they can't depend on you, who can they depend on? You still command, no matter what Kellan Elisadil might have said. Besides, a dead king can't do anything to save us from his mess. Only a live captain of the Home Guard can do that."
Pied slept for a time, too tired to argue the point. When he woke, it was midday, and the Home Guard was deep in the tangle of hills north of the flats, pulling together the strays and the lost, linking up with other units that still looked to stand and fight somewhere in spite of what had happened the night before. Most were in shock, but word had spread that Pied Sanderling had led a successful counterattack against the Federation and damaged the airship and weapon that had destroyed their fleet. While others had run, the captain of the Home Guard had stood his ground. If there was any hope for the elves, it lay with him. Pied heard the talk, even though the words were whispered and the looks cast his way furtive. Drum hadn't exaggerated. Everyone was depending on him. He might have been an ex-captain of the Home Guard 24 hours earlier, but he was back in harness, like it or not. He could choose to set the record straight, but what good would that do? The Elven army needed confidence and determination. He knew better than most how to provide that, and he was in a position to do so. To forego that responsibility would be to commit a violation of trust worse than anything Kellan Elisadil had ever imagined. So he had called together his sub-commanders and lieutenants and devised a plan that would give them a chance to stall the Federation advance. In these hills, the elves were a less visible target than on the flats or in the skies. Here, they could be more elusive as the terrain better suited their style of fighting. The Federation army was advancing on them with the intention of crushing any final resistance they might offer, then flanking and surrounding their freeborn allies. Putting a stop to their effort might very well determine the outcome of the entire war. With a plan in place and the army regrouped, Drum had persuaded Pied to go back to sleep. He was still battered from his tumble out of the sky, still exhausted enough that he needed to rest. Nothing he could do now was more important than what he would do when the Federation found them. "And now," he thought, opening his eyes once more to stare up into the still darkened sky, "it has." He looked at Drummondoon. "Any sign of their airships?" He pushed himself up on one elbow with a grunt. The resulting aches and pains gave evidence of the time and distance he must travel still before he healed. "What about that big ship that was carrying their weapon?"
"No airships in sight at all,"
his aide responded, reaching down to pull him all the way up and handing him the chainmail vest he always wore in battle. Pied stared in disbelief.
How in the world did you find this?
I never let go of it, Captain,
the other man advised, giving him a wry smile.
I knew you'd be needing it when you came back.
That he believed Pied would come back spoke volumes about his faith in his commander. Pied pulled on the vest, buckled on the leather greaves and arm guards that Drum had also somehow salvaged, strapped on a short sword and long knife, and slung his bow and arrows across his back. He shook his head.
You never cease to amaze me, Drum.
He stretched, adjusted the armor and weapons, and nodded.
All right, lead the way.
They went down through the camp to cheers and waves from the elven hunters and home guard. The ranks of the previous day had swelled to double, and in some cases, triple what they had been. Units that had been broken and scattered reformed and made whole again overnight. The day was clear and the sky cloudless, but the light was pale and silvery on the horizon, the sun still down behind the hills. When it lifted into view, it would blind those walking into it. Accordingly, Pied had set his defensive line in a low rise that placed the elves with their backs to the sun and required their enemies to come at them from out of a wide draw that was flanked by high hills on either side. The draw led out of a 10-mile-long cut that twisted through the twin plateaus of the Precandoran, a natural passage that seemed to those marching north to be the beginning of a clear opening to the land beyond. But the look was deceptive. After entering the draw, it became apparent that navigating a series of narrow defiles was then necessary to reach open terrain. Pied was hoping that whoever was leading the Federation Pursuit Force did not realize that. It was a realistic hope, given the fact that no Federation force had penetrated that far north in almost 50 years. Airships scouting the Precandoran might have noticed the lay of the land, but surveys so far north would have been deemed unimportant, or, even if made, long since forgotten or lost. He put his archers on the flanking heights and his home guard and regulars within the draw in two ranks,